This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Andrew, we miss you in Austin, Texas. It's good to have you back.
It's awesome to be here, always. I was thinking about I came to my first Bit Devs in Austin in like early 2021 at the old Unchained office, and just the mental vibration in that room, I was like, I got to be here.
Yeah.
So every time coming back to the Commons is awesome.
Yeah, especially on days like today. I'm sure you freaks are hearing some background noise right now. We've got the Pleb Lab Builder Day going on. Vibes are high. South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, trying to do the takeover here at the Commons. It's great to see more people in town. Yeah. Is Austin the Bitcoin capital of the world in your mind?
I think it has to be. People should come experience the energy for themselves. Go to a BitDevs, go to a, they have like the Lightning Day, the Bitcoin Day, this Pleb Lab thing, the takeover tomorrow. It's refreshing. It's like a reminder of why you're in this industry.
Yeah.
Like you can read what's on Twitter, read what's in the news, work on your computer from home. But until you're in an environment like this, just like that's when you realize why you're here.
Yeah. Why are you here, Andrew? What brought you here?
How deep were you going?
We're going very deep. You texted me the other day, like, what are we going to cover at all? We've been planning this for 2 years now.
Right.
I remember vividly running into you, and I believe it was your brother.
Yeah.
At Loro.
Michael Myers.
Yes. It was, I think, 2 years ago now at this point.
Yeah.
I was like, we got to record.
Yeah.
We're aligned on many things. Some things I may be missing in the world of energy,
right?
Particularly around solar. But let's start, like, why are you here? Why Bitcoin? Why Satoshi Energy?
I think it's good to find something to work on that feels like destiny. So there's just a lot of decisions I made in life that put me in this position, but just got really interested in energy, 2009. I was studying abroad in Australia, studying energy. Went to grad school and studied power markets, data science, a bunch of things that are super applicable to what I'm doing now. And then moved to San Francisco, staying on my friend's couch in 2014. And he orange-pilled me, got me into Bitcoin. And when it clicked at that moment, I thought, you've got these 24/7 power markets and a 24/7 financial protocol. Like this money will be used for financial settlement in power markets. And just the wheels kept turning, and like 5.5 years ago started Satoshi Energy, and executing on that vision now. So there's just a lot of coincidences along the way that kind of help show you that you're on the right path.
Yeah. It's crazy to have that recognition in 2014, because that's early to connect the energy markets and Bitcoin. Because we have, this is the S1 up here that was released, I believe,
didn't even
in 2013. Yeah.
Yeah. No, oh yeah, maybe I did just
launched. Like ASICs were barely a thing then. And that intuition that early is pretty impressive.
That's where, yeah. So that was about a decade ago that I had that insight.
Yeah.
And when I think back on it, it was just some sort of like you open yourself up to ideas and then they come in, and that was one of those things that I don't know. I feel very grateful to have had that insight at that time.
Yeah. And it's like, this is something I'm becoming more convinced of every day. Like understanding power markets, grids, energy extraction, whether it's upstream oil and gas wells, solar panels, wind farms. Like these are foreign concepts to most people that should be taught like in high school. Like we take for granted our ability to have these lights, this mic, these cameras, the fact that it just works. And I guess that's a jumping off point for the question of like, what do people commonly misunderstand about power markets or just completely gloss over that they should understand?
Well, it's complex, so there's a lot of things that people who are novice to it don't understand. Even people who are in it barely understand. I was thinking yesterday that, like, Bitcoin is minting money, but it's also minting a lot of new energy nerds, which is kind of a cool thing. Because when you're in the industry and, like, you care a lot about it and you see all these interesting opportunities in this very kind of antiquated, heavily regulated business, and then all these other people start pouring in and actually having interest in it, it's kind of, it's, like, really reassuring. But I think one of the biggest things that I think a lot of people don't understand is just how regulated the industry is and how those regulations impact the industry. So most of the industry operates under these monopoly utilities. And so 100 years ago, they're granted their monopoly power. They're called natural monopolies, but there's nothing natural about it. And basically the way it works is that the utility is given a monopoly territory, and they work with a public utility commission, a government entity, government-appointed entity, in order to set the rates for power. The way that works, it's called a rate of return regulation. So it creates this conflict of interest where the utility with a monopoly on the power, on delivering the power, they get their profits as a return on the capital that they deploy. So their incentive is to deploy as much capital as possible. And the way they do that is they set a fixed price for energy. Doesn't matter what the supply or demand is in the market at any given time of day. They just set a fixed price so that the demand side is not flexible, and that drives up peak demand and drives up the need to build more power generation and more power transmission. So technologically speaking, we don't have any sort of a reliability issue. We don't have technology issues. We don't have issues with, like, scarcity of energy, energy prices, anything like that. What we have is a giant regulatory stranglehold on how humans consume energy. I think that's the biggest thing that people miss and don't really understand.
It's a government problem at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So you mentioned this quote unquote natural monopoly was granted 100 years ago. What happened 100 years ago?
We're going to go deep.
Let's go.
So a lot of people like to talk about, you know, the Federal Reserve, and some people have come across Thomas Edison, Henry Ford's plan to create energy-backed money about 100 years ago. So through my research, my understanding, Federal Reserve was created, political media apparatus, obviously pushing for the creation of the Federal Reserve and central banking, despite the founding fathers and many other very intelligent people saying that central banking is not a great idea. Ford and Edison were actually initially in favor of the creation of the Fed, just because there was banking volatility, banking issues at the time, and they wanted a solution. But a few years in, it started creating market volatility, boom and bust cycles, and they're like, wait a second, like, this is not working. So they set out to create this commodity-backed money, this energy-backed money. And at that same time, that same sort of political media apparatus said, hey, actually, we need to, these energy companies are getting out of control. We need to create these monopolies and start to regulate this business. So it was really the same set of kind of politicians and media people who were pushing for the Federal Reserve ended up creating what was called the Public Utility Holding Company Act that created all the monopoly utilities a few years after the Fed.
Fascinating. And was it like fear-mongering around energy the same way they fear-monger around money? Like, we need somebody to control this, to create stability.
Yeah.
Like, with electricity, obviously, it is a dangerous thing to handle in some regards if you don't do it correctly. It was just a big fear-mongering, like, we need to regulate this because people could die.
It was meme warfare 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So there's a really famous picture of all these crisscrossed power lines and, like, people, like, getting shocked and dying and, like, a skeleton laying on the power line. It scared people that, oh yeah, you can't have, all these crisscrossing power lines and, like, duplicative investment in the infrastructure. Like, you need to just have a nice, clean, single power line from a centrally managed utility, and everything will work better that way. So it killed competition in the industry.
So in your mind, is there, like, a more efficient, ideal way to do power transmission?
The best example is Texas, and not necessarily for power transmission. So Texas is a great example of deregulated supply and demand, but the transmission is still heavily regulated. There are some pockets of private transmission lines. It's like the whole idea of if there's no government, who's going to build the roads?
Yes. Well, we just had a long discussion about that with the Bitcoin urbanists. Like, nice. It's insane. Like, who's going to build the roads?
Right. And so if there's no government or no centrally managed utility, who's going to manage the power lines? Or if it's open to competition, then people are going to build two power lines next to each other, and that's not going to look good or whatever. But by not allowing that, you create this sort of regulatory bottleneck, especially on the transmission side. So despite the open free market in Texas, which is great, it's invited a lot of new energy investment. So there's a lot of really low-cost wind, low-cost solar in the market. There's competition amongst retailers, so that will drive prices down for the end customer. But you still have that transmission aspect that's heavily regulated, where if you could unlock that, you would even see a greater abundance of energy and more resilience, in my opinion. So if you can deregulate the transmission, then you have people starting to build private transmission lines and start to create these microgrids and local grids that connect to regional grids and ultimately to the market-to-market grids and the international grids. The best example of this that I've been thinking about lately is I can't build just a small distribution line from my house to my neighbor's house and sell them energy. It's illegal to do that, to put a wire between my house, and my neighbor's house, meter it and sell them energy. Mm-hmm. What's immoral about that? What's wrong about that? What's dangerous about that? Nothing.
Yeah. The government's not in control. They need to control this. They can't trust you. That's the thing. You're going to electrocute your neighbor.
Yeah.
Who are you to make money?
Might happen.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network, and you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and their rolling out a bunch of other products, including Inheritance Protocol and Sound Advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com. It is insane to think that the government has fucked up so many things, whether it's the money, electricity, we were just talking about urban environments and suburban sprawl. Like, when it comes to energy, again, going anchoring to the fact that I think the two most important tools we leverage as humans today are energy and money, and it's been corrupted beyond belief. And what you just mentioned there, these little microgrids, falling back to like information theory and complex systems, like that's the beauty of Bitcoin. It is this complex system that's distributed in nature, and the fact that it's distributed and modular creates this extremely robust and resilient system that any human can anchor into. And we need to apply that design thinking, distributed design thinking, to other areas of life, energy probably being one of the most important. It's like, how fragile does the centralization of the power markets leave society at the end of the day?
Yeah, we're seeing it now. And I mean, you can even take that back to markets themselves, right? So there's capitalism, the voluntary exchange of goods and services. That's what a market is. The power market should work that way. Money should work that way through competition and cooperation. And it does, like, you don't necessarily need a central party to tell you what to do and to keep it and make it safe. But in terms of, what's going on in the world right now, there's headlines all over the place even Netflix movies, saying that the grid is going to come down from a cyber attack. Well, if you create all these central points of failure from a centrally managed grid in a very top-down structure, that's not very resilient to cyber attacks. It's not resilient to bad weather. It's not resilient to an earthquake, forest fire, anything that could cause outages. And it's in these centralized entities, one, they're not incentivized to build that more resilient grid or to build these microgrids or to distribute the power generation and the consumption and the transmission and distribution. So if you open up that market, you know, individual economic actors can make those choices and start to do that. So I think that's how we ultimately get to that more resilient grid and get past where we're at today, where everybody in the back of their mind is like, what do I do if the power goes out?
Do you think the Bitcoin mining industry is providing a path to that more free market design? Because you got to think the economics of Bitcoin mining are set, like the energy pirates of the world, the Bitcoin miners are really going and finding these inefficiencies and doing this price arbitrage play essentially at the end of the day and soaking up wasted excess energy to make a profit and turn it into the hardest money that has ever existed. Do you think energy companies are seeing what miners are doing and being like, holy shit, like if only we could do this everywhere else, it would really open up things? And is that pure economic incentive? Is that enough of a catalyst to be like, all right, let's push to open up these markets a bit more?
Yeah, I think it's happening in a lot of different ways. And I think in the future, it's going to be even bigger. So right now, Bitcoin mining is improving the financial sustainability of power generation investments and power transmission investments. So what we're doing as a company, we're helping wind farms, solar farms, utility scale power production to monetize their excess energy, their riskiest, lowest value energy, and sell that to Bitcoin data centers while still getting the optionality and the value of selling power into the market. So we're improving the financial resiliency, sustainability of those investments, which means that they'll be able to continue to maintain that equipment, provide power to the market with that equipment, invest in new power generation. And that's all great. That's like a very clear cut and dry value proposition that's happening today for sure. There's also the sort of the location agnostic nature of Bitcoin data centers. And so they're able to go anywhere, consume that surplus power. But part of it is like, at least in the structures that we do, where we're co-locating the power generation or the data center with the power generation, we're effectively creating these small two-party markets. And in the future, I think more parties involved at these like substation locations with high power capacity, where you're starting to create these little microgrids and these little, you know, two-party or three-party or more party marketplaces and working towards that kind of microgrid type of future or just like decentralized grid type of future. But I think the bigger opportunity, and part of this is happening right now, you have the regulatory and political lobby of Bitcoin data centers, right? So in ERCOT, as an example, always a great example. It's the center of the universe here in Texas. You know, you went from, say, 75 gigawatts of total power production and peak demand in the ERCOT market. And then over the last 5 years, you know, 30, 40 gigawatts of new load interconnection requests, mostly from Bitcoin data centers. And then, you know, a few gigawatts have been built. There's a ton of demand for more of them. And all of those companies are now in the ERCOT market meetings. You know, they're putting through, you know, revision requests to the ERCOT protocols. They're in the stakeholder meetings. They're saying, hey, this can be done a better way. And then they're also lobbying politically to say, let's not gum this up with more regulations or just anything heavy handed. And so I think that sort of political backing from Bitcoin miners is really important right now. And then the bigger theme is moving towards a society with sound money. So as these companies, the people who have this classical liberal capitalist mindset, which is by nature a peaceful, voluntary exchange of goods and services, they are starting to accumulate capital. Capital is flowing into those businesses. Value is going into Bitcoin. And ultimately, the people with knowledge and with money are going to be able to make the decisions in the future, whether it's politically or economically. So I think we're going to see, and I've been kind of on the fence, like, will power generation companies buy out Bitcoin data centers, or will the Bitcoin data centers ultimately buy out the power generation and make the power generation investments? Despite our best efforts, a lot of these energy companies are going way too slow on making the Bitcoin investments, while the Bitcoin miners are just accumulating Bitcoin and ultimately are just going to be like, it is not unreasonable to imagine 5 years from now that some of these big public Bitcoin mining companies holding 5,000, 10,000 Bitcoin are at a higher valuation than Exxon or Chevron or any of the major energy companies, and they buy them out.
Yeah. Why do you think the energy companies are moving so slow right now? Or why are they? I mean, you know, you're in the room with them.
Yeah. It's a capital intensive business. It's not a business of innovation, or hasn't been, largely because of the last 100 years of regulation. And they're just conservative businesses. So they're trying to make a decent return on capital, basically trying to beat inflation. And this idea of Bitcoin, and don't get me wrong, there's a few big energy companies investing in Bitcoin mining right now, holding Bitcoin on their balance sheet. It's not public, but they're doing it. And, across the board, they're selling power to Bitcoin miners. But to make a decision to invest in a Bitcoin data center, or buy Bitcoin and hold Bitcoin on their balance sheet, or accept Bitcoin as a form of payment, there just aren't a ton of courageous leaders at the top of these energy companies that are willing to take that risk, or like risk their reputation to do that. But I think all of that's changing right now. I think some of the updates to the accounting rules last year, and then also the spot ETF this year, you look at like the investment funds that created a spot ETF, and then the ones that didn't, like at least one example of the ones that didn't, the CEO got outed a few months after. Was that because of some other reason, or was that because he made a bad strategic mistake? So I tend to think that the same thing's going to happen with energy companies. Like once those big asset managers, those big investment funds who invest in all these energy companies start to say, hey, energy company, like, why are you not investing in Bitcoin? Like, we want that Bitcoin. You know, the Bitcoin is going to be the only way for this investment to actually appreciate in value. The money is either going to naturally flow into the energy companies. The investment's going to naturally flow into the energy companies that have a strong position in Bitcoin. Or there's just going to be a top-down directive from these investment firms that says, hey, you need to be accumulating Bitcoin for me. Start doing it today.
Yeah. Yeah. The career risk is about to flip where
exactly
historically up to this point, first 15 years, career risk has been like, if I get into Bitcoin and it explodes, I'm out. Now it's like, I think we're very, very much at the point where it's like, if I don't have a Bitcoin strategy for the next, like within 5 years, if 5 years passes and I have not implemented a Bitcoin strategy into our business, I am out. It was a strategic decision that was not good in hindsight. Like, mm-hmm. That's going to be abundantly clear in 5 years. And so that's something that excites me incredibly. And like for energy companies specifically, like Bitcoin mining, monetizing stranded or excess surplus energy is just one aspect of it. Like that's like the hard commodity production side of it. But then you get to like the network side of it, and what you guys are working on as well, like creating capital efficiencies from like paying for that electricity in Bitcoin over something like the Lightning Network takes it to a whole nother level.
Yeah. What I tell energy companies, something I've been saying recently is like, so the major parts of the energy business that we work with. So we'll work with the origination teams of these energy companies, which is effectively their sales team trying to sell the power. And then they have a credit/risk team that, you know, the origination team, they're like, oh, this is a massive power consumer. This is like, you know, my bonus is going to go up if I sell this much power. The profits of the business are going to go up if I sell this much power. And then the credit and risk team, they say, well, hold on, that like, this is magic internet money. This is not a credit-worthy investment grade off-taker. And if we start to increase our exposure to this customer class, what could happen? It could be really bad for this business. So we're starting to see more alignment between the two, but there's still these kind of very, I think, cliche at this point type of, you know, objections to Bitcoin, which is like, what if the Bitcoin price goes to zero? And so what I've been saying recently is like, I think they're starting to understand like it's not going to zero, it's not going away. But what if Bitcoin goes to infinity? What if the Bitcoin price goes to infinity? What is your entire, you know, value of all of your assets start to look like under that paradigm? And so that's one part of it. But I think the way to approach that, even if you're a conservative energy company, is, you know, you're selling power to Bitcoin data centers now. That's a great first step. They're starting to make, you know, small equity investments into the data centers. Also a great next step. I think, you know, potentially keeping a revenue share, some of that in Bitcoin in those investments is a really good way to start getting exposure. And then with the power contracts themselves, like for example, we're building this real-time invoicing, real-time settlement in order to help them minimize the risk of an unpaid bill. So minimizing accounts receivable risk. And in that you can pay with dollars. You can do like a daily dollar payment. But what they can also do is, for example, say, hey, how about 1% of our energy bill we start taking in Bitcoin? The other 99% we'll take in dollars. We'll use the dollars for our traditional, you know, operations and expenses associated with that. But we'll keep the 1%. We'll just hold it on the balance sheet. And that'll be a way to accumulate Bitcoin over time.
Yeah, and this is something that's enabled uniquely by Bitcoin, specifically how block reward payouts are distributed via mining pools. Like you actually, as the Bitcoin miner, your service that you're selling is to the Bitcoin network and get paid out pretty regularly for doing that. Whereas another demand source for these, like these power purchase agreements, they have other businesses where their accounts receivable, they may have like N30 and N45 and N90, whatever it is. And then they have to go back and pay their bills eventually, which could be N30 and N45 and N90 as well. But like Bitcoin, since you're selling the service directly to the network and getting paid almost immediately, you find a block in a pool, you have to wait 100 blocks for the reward, but pools have treasury management where they can do FPPS and pay out every day a set fee. So you actually have the ability as a Bitcoin miner to pay this on the go. And now we have companies like Brains enabling the Lightning Network for these payouts as well, which streamlines a lot of this accounting.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of Bitcoin mining, right, is that you're converting energy nearly instantaneously into money. Like what better energy customer is there than that?
Yeah.
So we talk to a lot of big retail energy companies and they have different customer classes that they sell to. And for a long time they thought, oh, the commercial real estate market is a great customer class. It's this big customer class of all these businesses that are operating profitably and they're going to keep paying their energy bills. Well, that's taken a downturn and it's actually not a great customer class for them now. Same with residential consumers. So residential consumers are absolutely struggling right now. Like something like, I might be misspeaking, but something like 30% of residential energy bills are either late on payment or completely unpaid. So that creates a massive liability on the books of the energy companies. So who's going to pay for energy in the future? It's going to be Bitcoin miners and everyday people holding Bitcoin who actually have value to then buy goods and services in the economy. It's not going to work on a dollar standard.
No. 30%?
Yeah, something crazy like that.
In that ballpark?
Yeah. Yeah.
You look at it and that's one stat. The other stat is you look at like credit card delinquency rates over 90 days, they're creeping up to 2006, 2007 levels. Like the consumer is certainly under stress when you think of the fact that like 30% or in that ballpark are not paying their electricity bills. That paints a pretty stark, dark picture because you think when it comes to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that's like one of the things that you make sure you pay month in and month out.
What's even more interesting about that? So if a lot of your customers can't pay their bills, somebody still has to pay for that. So what does the utility do? They raise rates for the rest of the people who can pay their bills. So rates go up for the people who can pay it, but the higher those power rates go up, the more incentivized those people are to just exit the grid altogether. So there's a concept of the Bitcoin mining death spiral, which I think actually borrowed from what is a real phenomenon called the utility death spiral. So people stop paying their bills, you raise rates for the people who can pay their bills. Rates are so high and the cost of solar, home storage, home energy production is falling. You eventually reach a point of parity where those people say, okay, I'm just going to produce my own power. I don't need to buy from the utility. So the utility at some point is left with no customers because of the way that they're pricing energy and the way that they're, you know, perceiving risk and not properly accounting for it.
Yeah. And so are the alarm bells going off throughout the utility sector right now?
This has been going on for over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like, I wouldn't call it alarm bells. I would call it quiet desperation.
Okay. Why is that?
It's the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like, it's an obvious problem. And there's even more kind of crazy things going on in these markets with these companies where they, you know, they have, people have comfortable jobs. Everything's like going, you know, steady as it goes now. But they're seeing all these risks start to accumulate and they're all trying to fight over like the remaining customers who can actually pay bills.
Yeah.
But it's not sustainable.
No. Does Bitcoin fix this?
Bitcoin is a great tool to fix everything, right? Yeah. But it's going to take
time,
people, time and people and effort and work to actually build up the economy back from where it's at now.
Systemically fragile state that we find it in.
Yeah. Fragile yet surprisingly resilient. Mm-hmm. And full of opportunity, full of potential. So,
yeah. And speaking of opportunity, we were discussing before we hit record, like in the Bitcoin mining industry specifically, like, do you agree with the thesis that the biggest opportunity is in developing rack space infrastructure?
That is definitely a very large opportunity right now. So, because it takes so long to develop projects and projects at scale to sell power, and there's so much demand from Bitcoin mining right now that there's just a real shortage of power capacity, and that's just Bitcoin mining. You now have increased demand from you know, AI data centers, other traditional data centers. Data itself is just such a huge part of our economy and a growing part of our economy that trend is not going to stop. So yes, there's a huge shortage of power capacity. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, you have this influx of wind power, solar power, very low cost renewable generation, you know, mixed with the rest of the power production stack. But with wind and solar in particular, you have this correlation risk where if the wind is blowing across all of these wind generators or the sun is shining across all of these solar generators, it starts to drive down prices for all of them. So they're a little bit on the fence of like, do I keep building this generation if it's going to be risky in that way? Or do I just hold off and deploy that capital elsewhere? But that's where Bitcoin mining comes in. And it's like, okay, you can still have that correlation risk, but you can capture that surplus to support and back and secure the money supply now. So it's really taking the risk out of power generation investments. I think this is really underappreciated by a lot of power executives, is that you can keep overbuilding wind and solar now, and you can monetize that surplus energy. You might not get like the PPA price that you were looking for, you know, last year or 5 years ago, but you're going to set up basically a floor on any power that you produce, and you'll be able to monetize that lowest value, riskiest energy, and you still get all the upside in the merchant market, or you can also sign a separate PPA on that power and have the investment pencil out.
Yeah, and if you're wise enough to actually accumulate Bitcoin, you can get a lot of value from Bitcoin's price appreciation over time as well.
That too, yeah.
Yeah. Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com. Safe spelled SAIF, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC. $40 off. So, what is the optimal energy generation mix? Because this problem not only exists for wind and solar, when you have increased production of wind and solar throughout the day, if the wind's blowing and the sun's shining, that only doesn't drive prices negative for those power producers. It drives prices negative for natural gas producers, nuclear power plants in the market as well. And that has led to a lack of investment in those what are deemed to be more reliable energy sources in favor of wind and solar, which have been highly subsidized via renewable energy credits. But I think, I talked about this with Jamie McCavity from Cormit last month, and I think there's a way to have it all. Would you agree?
I asked him the question. I still don't know the answer to it, but what would the price of energy be in ERCOT without wind and solar? My thing is it would be higher. I don't think it would be lower without them. But I think that the answer to what is the optimal power mix is what does the market decide is the optimal power mix? So, and I think from a subsidies perspective, yes, subsidies exist for wind and solar, but the entire oil and gas and fossil fuel industry has been heavily subsidized for a very long time. So I think I tend to think of those as sort of a wash. Neither side really has that much of an advantage over the other. My general hypothesis is that we as a society, or me as an individual investor, I would like to utilize the low cost nature of wind and solar for applications where it makes sense. So for example, there's this been a discussion around energy density in the Bitcoin mining space. So there's a lot of Bitcoiners who say, okay, Bitcoin uses energy, and for that reason, we need energy density to power their grid and power our Bitcoin data centers. That is just a completely false assumption. So the value of energy density is really for dynamic loads, like a car where you need to move from point A to point B using a small amount of energy. When it comes to a stationary load, like a data center, you don't need reliability and you don't need energy density. And there's plenty of land to build wind, to build solar, and all of that. So you can produce all this very low-cost renewable energy, and it doesn't need to be reliable for certain applications like Bitcoin data centers. And then for all of the things that need high uptime or energy density, that's when you have the rest of the power mix. So, even taking this to the extreme, what are some interesting energy-dense applications that you could use? If you think about nuclear power, there's been a lot of people in the Bitcoin space want to see more nuclear power for Bitcoin mining. And I'm not opposed to that, but you can also think of many interesting applications for nuclear energy, nuclear power transportation or planes or, I like to think of a future where it's your Apple Watch is just a 1 megawatt nuclear generator in there, and it can do all kinds of crazy computation and other things, or nuclear power, as we, explore space, use it for those applications. And sure, it's great as a source of grid power, but it's not a necessity. So this actually ties back to the idea of the demand side elasticity or the lack thereof. So most power loads do not need 99.9% uptime. especially Bitcoin data centers. So you utilize the unreliable but very low cost renewable energy, use it for those applications, and then for everything else that does require high uptime, that's where you have, you know, gas peaker plants, you have battery storage, you have you know, hydro capacity, maybe nuclear, maybe other forms of power generation. But for everything else, just pump in the wind and solar.
Yeah, but how? I agree, there may not be demand. Like demand, obviously peak demand comes very seldomly, two times a year here in Texas specifically, probably similar in many other places. But that's the problem, right? Is like you need it when you need it. And to get it when you need it, like you need to have everything built out and producing at that point in time. Like, and then reliability in the Bitcoin miner context, it's a spectrum, right? Like depending on the ASICs that you have, the price that you accumulated them at and plug them in, like you have different reliability needs based on those upfront capital injections into your business.
But if we're just talking about base load, so like everyday power consumers, and you think about like the summer peaks and the winter peaks, those peaks are exacerbated by the fact that most of these customers are under fixed prices. Hmm. So yes, you can build more generation to meet those peaks, but you can also do more demand response. So Bitcoin data centers obviously doing demand response and reducing those peaks from their own perspective. But the same is true for, I think Jamie talked about this on the podcast with you too. He called it like family pool time or something like that, or yeah, family sauna time.
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, if my power price, if I'm on a time of use rate for my power, if it's a really hot afternoon and my power prices are going through the roof, well, okay, maybe like we just go outside for a couple hours and we save money by doing that. And that's an economic decision that everybody can choose to make. They can still lock in their power prices, but they don't have to. So this supply side and the demand side balance is really important. Right now, it's just highly skewed on the demand side, creating these massive peaks, because the way I like to frame it is that like the average person's ability to make an economic decision on when to buy power has been severely atrophied because the last 100 years have just given them one fixed price.
Yeah.
You wear a crutch, you wear a cast on your leg for 100 years, your leg's not going to work. So people just have to get a little bit more comfortable with the fact that like energy is a dynamic market. And there are ways to kind of, you know, buy and sell energy just like you do other goods and services. When price goes up, maybe you buy less of it. When price goes down, you buy more of it.
Yeah. Do you envision a future where we just have such an abundance of energy and electricity capacity that we don't have to worry about any of this? Because that's like the ideal state in my mind. Let me know if I'm wrong, but like we should just overbuild generation to an extent that's almost obscene, mine Bitcoin with the surplus, maybe get to the Nakamoto point that Dhruv Bansal down the hall has put out there, and just not have to like worry about family time or anything like that.
I think that's a possibility. I think as we get back to a sound money society, you know, you're going to have natural innovation and deflation, which I think is a good thing. The cost of energy will go down, and the total sort of like value and ability to, you know, use money for other things will go up for the average household. So the portion of their total budget that they're spending on energy should decrease to the point where it's like, yeah, keep consuming more of it. Like it doesn't make a huge difference.
Yeah. It's the world I want to live in.
Me too.
What do you think, bringing us back to Satoshi Energy and your intersection of the energy sector and Bitcoin mining, we've talked about where the energy executives may be missing what's going on with Bitcoin, but where are like Bitcoin miners as they begin to interact with these utilities and energy companies? What are they doing wrong, or what could they be doing better in terms of understanding their counterparties in this trade that they're making?
It's changed a lot in the last 5 years. So one of the things that kind of motivated me and like helped guide the strategic vision of Satoshi Energy is that, you know, 5 years ago, as I really started going in full time on this, I would see a Bitcoin mining company that's just reaching scale or trying to reach scale, and they're hiring for an energy manager. So every Bitcoin mining company ultimately needs some level of energy expertise within their organization to be able to make good investment decisions and sign the right power contracts and de-risk those investments and ultimately continue to be a profitable business. So 5 years ago, that was like virtually non-existent. There were a couple that had really strong energy teams, and they're succeeding today and they're growing today. More and more, you know, Bitcoin mining companies, as I said, like Bitcoin is minting a bunch of energy nerds. So there's a lot more energy people coming into the Bitcoin mining space. There's people who are already in Bitcoin that are just getting up to speed on energy. I think Cormint is an amazing example of that. Like, they're doing super sophisticated financing and power contracts, without much of a background in energy. So there's just a lot more energy expertise within these Bitcoin mining companies now. And so I don't think there's a lot of, there's honestly not a lot of shortcomings in terms of Bitcoin mining companies communicating with energy companies now. It's more of the energy companies don't really appreciate or understand the value of the Bitcoin mining.
Hmm.
And what value that provides to the grid, what value that provides financially, what is the long-term outlook of Bitcoin mining and Bitcoin itself. But the mining companies, they know they need low-cost energy. They generally know how to get it. The major point of friction right now is in negotiating with these energy companies is that the energy companies completely misunderstand the value proposition of Bitcoin mining.
Yeah. And like, in your mind, does the Bitcoin mining industry prevent an avenue to create really unique PPAs, like longer PPAs, because, you know, the demand's always going to be there to facilitate block production? Because that's what I'm thinking as like a Bitcoin miner. What's the average PPA now, like 5 years?
PPAs for power generation with a non-Bitcoin offtaker, so like a large corporate, Google data center, Amazon data center, large industrial, big utility, those have typically been in the range of 15 to 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen shorter durations on the PPAs with Bitcoin data centers. I think one, because, you know, Bitcoin, the economics of Bitcoin mining are certainly getting more competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to look out 20 years and say, this is a price I'm willing to pay.
Yeah.
In 20 years when you have four halvings in that, mm-hmm. five halvings in that time frame. But I think the next step here, a really important step, is going to be investment in new power generation, where instead of your primary creditworthy offtaker or your anchor tenant being one of these big corporates or being a big utility or a big traditional data center company, it's starting to look at the Bitcoin mining investment as potentially being your anchor tenant, where you can build a power generation asset, you put a Bitcoin data center with it, and that Bitcoin data center, like I said earlier, is going to set a floor on the price. So, you know, this is the minimum amount I'm going to get. And then I can, you know, make assumptions or forecast what I think the merchant upside will look like with that investment. And from there, you can actually make a sound investment and know that, like, you're going to have kind of a minimum rate of return on that investment by including the data center.
Yeah. And it improves the economics for these power generators while they're waiting for transmission to be built out too, right? Because hypothetically, you could build a generation asset and then put a Bitcoin mining operation behind the meter as transmission's being built out and monetize that asset while you're waiting to connect to the grid.
I certainly think that's an option, but transmission build out is not without risk. So if you're going to make that type of investment, you just want to be sure that it's a very locked in transmission deal.
Okay.
Like, they're already cleared from a regulatory perspective. They have all their land easements and everything squared away, the investment's there, and it's on a very clear timeline. And maybe that still takes, you know, 2-3 years to build. And so you can take that risk to energize your power generation today, put a Bitcoin data center there, monetize it today, knowing with some high level of certainty that you're going to get that transmission in the future and get that optionality to also sell power into the grid. But doing that in like a completely speculative way, where it's like,
mm-hmm.
you're out in the middle of the desert and there's no nearby transmission, and you're saying, okay, I'm going to build a wind farm and a solar farm and a in a Bitcoin mine and then kind of hope that the transmission comes to you, I think that's a little bit riskier and maybe not worth doing.
This is why we have you on the show, to point out these nuances.
Not a lot of people talk about this stuff.
Yeah. Because that's what makes sense to me. Like, if you're thinking about the energy stability problem in the country, and if a lot of these power generation facilities are having problems even getting off the ground because of the economics of the sunk capital that you put in, the time between when you deploy the capital, get everything built and connected, and the point at which you begin monetizing that asset to begin paying back all that capital investment. It just intuitively makes sense that, like, Bitcoin mining, being able to shorten the time between shovel in the ground and actually monetizing the asset, like, is massively beneficial for the proliferation of new energy capacity build out.
Ultimately, in the power generation investment, you want some optionality where you can sell your power. So there was some discussion years ago, you know, we're going to build completely off-grid power generation and Bitcoin mining, but you're missing out on optionality by doing that. So I think where we're going with power generation, especially solar and wind, is that you're going to have some mix of solar production, wind production, battery storage, and the Bitcoin mine, and the transmission interconnection. So what that means is, you know, when there's the most surplus energy, it's either going to go into the Bitcoin mine or it's going to go into the storage. And then when it goes into storage, you're storing it there for some period of time on the expectation that you can then sell it back into the grid or get other revenue streams from, like, ancillary services from that storage asset. And then when the value of energy is at its highest, when demand is at its highest, Bitcoin data centers off, not operating at all, not consuming any of the energy. And then if you have energy in the battery, you're going to sell that into the market and make that arbitrage. Or you're going to just put power from the power generation asset into the market and get all that upside in the market. Like, it's actually a very simple balance. And I think the way a lot of energy companies are structured today is you have a lot of energy developers who maybe they specialize in, you know, in the last, like, 15 years, 10 years, they specialized in building out wind farms, and that was it. They didn't really touch solar. They didn't touch storage. They didn't do other types of power generation. Now you're seeing a lot of new solar developers are coming into the space, and they just kind of focused on solar build out, but increasingly they're starting to build some expertise around battery storage. And so that's becoming part of the investment mix and part of the investment stack. And then increasingly they're becoming also more knowledgeable about the Bitcoin data center. So it takes time for this kind of expertise to ramp up to where somebody can properly, you know, project finance a project that has all of these components and see the true value in all of those components working together. And on top of that, there's, you know, regulatory and market complexities that make it challenging to have all of those assets work together in the market. But all of that is also being, you know, discussed and solved for in the changes to the market rules as well.
Yeah, you have to imagine with the increased optionality, those five options that you presented, that the cost of capital has to come down a bit for these projects as you de-risk it to a certain extent.
If I was a bank or a major investment firm, like, I would be pumping money into projects that have Bitcoin data centers on them and have storage and have the power generation and are, you know, on a good transmission line that can also sell power into a liquid market.
Yeah. Is the battery capacity solution the pipe dream that many people claim it is?
I'd say just read what Jesse Pelton puts out. He's got the numbers. And I think a lot of,
are they theoretical though?
No, it's very real and very economical now.
Okay.
Like, the cost of energy storage has dropped significantly in the last decade or two. Same is true for wind and solar. No, it's very economical. And, like, some of these battery companies, similar to Bitcoin mining companies that might have a hedge and they're able to liquidate that hedge in a very volatile market, like, some of these battery companies are able to, you know, just in a few hours out of the year, return their investment by arbing that energy.
Yeah. Yeah.
The technology is all there too. It's not like a, you know, pipe dream that the technology won't be there. It's there. There's batteries in everything too, right?
I know.
We all use phones. Yeah. Electric vehicles are increasing the battery production. Yeah, and there's plenty of resources on the planet, as we know, to build more of them.
I've gotten some strongly worded messages from you in the past for shitting on wind and solar specifically. Am I right at all thinking that like we should go for it all? We should do nuclear, wind, solar, coal, natural gas.
Well, I generally say let the market decide, but I think the market's going to decide that, yeah, do it all.
Yeah.
I think that the problem is, you know, we get back to like the reliability issue and the resiliency issue. There's maybe a certain class of people on this planet, if you want to call them that, that are trying to push for only wind, only solar, like in a place like Germany where that's not very sunny.
And doesn't it make any sense.
Creates reliability issues. And they're just ignoring the fact that like you still need some sort of backup power, and the best form of that backup power might be nuclear, might be gas generation. And so like at the same time as putting these very unreliable forms of power generation on the grid, they're also taking away the thing that's backing that up and maintaining the resiliency. That's a problem. You don't want that. Nobody sane wants that. But that doesn't mean that like putting more wind and solar on the grid is doing anything necessarily bad to it. I mean, all you have to do is look at ERCOT for the best example here. Like, lowest power prices globally, and also the most wind and most solar production in this market out of any other power market in the world.
Yeah. And with that in mind, I mean, Bitcoin miners, this stat when it came out a few weeks ago blew my mind, or 95% of large flexible load within ERCOT. I knew it was a lot. I didn't think it was like over 95%, which is pretty insane to think about. But with that in mind, like, what are your thoughts on the recent attack from Elizabeth Warren, Department of Energy, the EIA, this excise tax that's being proposed to be levied on Bitcoin miners, and the reaction from the industry, which I think was very effective?
Well, I don't want to give them any new ideas, but I've got, I think, a different take on this. So as a company, you know, we're not mining Bitcoin ourselves. And so the way I think about it strategically is that, you know, we keep an eye on these things. We want to make sure that our customers are not impacted by these things. But if for whatever reason there was some heavy-handed regulation on Bitcoin or Bitcoin mining in the United States and its energy consumption, like, we would have to find a way to adapt and move to different markets, which is part of building software that's very scalable to other markets. And same goes for the services that we provide to develop sites. Like, that can be done in other markets if Bitcoin mining is pushed to those other markets. I think, you know, we're all aware of the challenge that Bitcoin presents to the authoritarian government that we all live under from across most of this planet. But I think ultimately regulation is going to take the form of trying to get a piece of the pie rather than trying to kill it outright. So the great analogy, great example, and this actually ties back to like the differences of opinions that we've had about renewable energy. But 15, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, the renewable energy industry, they were the black sheep of the energy industry. They were up against all these regulated utilities saying, hey, we want to build renewable generation, provide this power into your grids, and you guys have to let us do that because it's supposed to be an open market. So like, they had to go through all these regulatory hurdles. They had to kind of change the public perspective on the industry, and ultimately they succeeded and they've gotten a major foothold in the industry. But what happened from a regulatory perspective, I think, is what happened. I think the people that wanted a piece of that pie, they saw, hey, this is a really trending industry, massively growing industry. How do I get a piece of it? So the best way to get a piece of that is to create a regulatory incentive that creates a tax credit for production of this energy. And then where does that tax credit go? It doesn't actually go to the companies that are investing and building the infrastructure and operating it. The tax credits go to the already profitable companies, the big banks and investment firms, that are able to actually monetize those tax credits. So I, and here's your, like, for all the regulators out there who want a piece of the pie, that's what you do.
Don't give them the idea.
create a Bitcoin production tax credit and get a piece of it. I don't think they should. I'm not.
Why are you giving them ideas?
I told you. You asked the question.
Why can't we just interact as consenting parties to sell and buy our goods and keep the government out of it?
I like to operate super transparently. Yeah. Like when I'm playing poker, I'll like sometimes just tell people what my hand is. They don't believe
That's
me.
That's a terrible strategy.
It's a winning strategy sometimes. It's the best bluff there is.
I mean, on this topic of authoritarianism, which I completely agree, has come to our shores. We do not live in a free country, which is obvious. The money is corrupted.
The money, we the education, live, the water, the healthcare.
The water.
What else?
Yeah. The food.
The food.
The media.
Education? Did I say education?
Yeah, you said education. Education's fucked. Do you think we're at an inflection point where people are getting enough pissed off at the government to have a pendulum swing back towards freedom?
It's heating up. I think there's not enough overlap between Bitcoiners and other conspiracy connoisseurs.
Mm-hmm. We're trying to get them in on the show. We've got Whitney.
Yeah, you're doing an awesome job.
We've got others coming in. But like, no, honestly, like you've spent a lot of time in El Salvador over the last year. What have you seen down there? Like in Bukele, they just announced they're dropping the income tax from 30% to 0%. Like it seems like despite what people would deem to be wrongdoings that Bukele has basically put forth over the last few years as he's made these drastic changes within El Salvador, I do think a lot of positive has come to it in terms of an example of a country just going tabula rasa, like we're going to build up from the ground up and try to allow a free market to flourish here. Like, what have you seen on the ground there in terms of the strategy actually working, if at all?
I can speak to El Salvador, but also just more broadly, it feels like we might be tapping out or kind of maxing out bottom-up growth of Bitcoin adoption. And there are a lot of people in this world, rightly so, who look to leaders to make some decisions for them. Like if there's something I'm not knowledgeable about, I find somebody who is an expert in that and they're my leader on that topic. So same is true for how the money works. And I think El Salvador is a great example of that, where it's a great top-down implementation. You have a strong, courageous leader who's not afraid to take that risk and promote something that's going to be good for his country, himself, society as a whole, and is able to kind of educate and, build the support in his country for that. So I tend to think that we need to see more of that. We need to see more, energy executives. We need to see more political, or at least like free market oriented political leaders promoting Bitcoin. More people in the media who are kind of media leaders promoting Bitcoin. And I think that's where the next big wave of adoption is going to come from. You always have the number go up technology, which gets a lot of new people into it. You also have a bunch of great businesses that are, making easier user experiences, making it just better for everyday people to adopt it and to use it. And that bottom up growth isn't going to stop. But I think we also need to approach it from both sides, more of the top down kind of like, hey guys, like we're doing this wrong. Let's fix this.
Yeah. I mean, just it builds very nicely on the conversation I just had with Austin Tunnell, Kelly Landon, and Ter Demeester, like applying a Bitcoin standard to the world of real estate development. And Austin, incredible story of what they've built at Building Culture, his company, to bring back sound, durable homes by using ancient masonry techniques. And they gave a presentation last night here at the Commons on Bitcoin urbanism. And it was really cool to hear Austin's story, particularly after meeting Ter, who's a very big enthusiast of quality aesthetics and durable architecture. And he sort of told Austin, like, hey, you should read the Bitcoin standard, like what you're doing and your approach and your philosophy behind building the houses that you do is really aligned with what Bitcoiners are striving for in terms of sound money and bringing back low time preference to the world. And I agree, like maybe this is like the middle layer of what you're describing between ground up and top down, but like finding these leaders and other tangential movements or verticals that have recognized that there's a very big problem in the world. It affects what they do very acutely, and just getting in there and saying like, hey, Bitcoin may be able to help you out here.
I had a energy executive tell me last week that he looks at Bitcoin as a nerd prepper money. So
it's not too far off.
It's not, but I think it is part of the current general outlook on Bitcoin. I think from most people who are not in it, is they say, well, if the money doesn't work, if the dollar fails, I need guns and food and land, and I need to go off grid. I think that's the wrong assumption. It's like Bitcoin is already filling cracks in society, and like what you said with you know, Austin and Kelly and others, like they're already using the wealth that they're accumulating with Bitcoin and using the ability to store value in Bitcoin as a way to build up society back to where it once was and then beyond there. So it's like people get so accustomed to their day-to-day lives that they forget to look at history and what the world looked like back on a sound money standard. The architecture, the quality of the food, the way humans actually treated each other. And that's just slowly dissolved through fiat money. But if we go back to sound money, we don't have to go through some Mad Max scenario necessarily. It might happen. I'm ready for it.
Mandibles.
But we can just build up from here. It'll be great.
Yeah. No, it's funny that he called it nerd prepper money. Again, this is something we've talked about behind the scenes too. It's like the propaganda strong. Like you're a prepper if you believe in sound money,
right?
And are pushing it forward, and that's a great shame and very frustrating. But again, I do think the inflationary pressures that people are feeling in their everyday lives right now are beginning to weaken the control the propaganda has had over their lives up to this point, where it's like, all right, you're telling me that everything's good, that the economy is growing, that inflation's coming down, but I'm literally not seeing that when I go to the grocery store, when I go to the gas station. Like, you may be lying to me. Maybe these nerd preppers are onto something here.
Yeah, I mean, the term prepper, similar to like the term conspiracy theorist, is just a psyop to get people to think that it's bad to be thinking about these things. Yep. So what is a prepper fundamentally? It's someone who cares about their own survival. Every human should care about their own survival.
Yeah.
And then once you have that covered, then think about thriving. How do we pass that down to future generations? How do we live a more abundant lifestyle? How do we live a more peaceful lifestyle? Yeah.
How do you think we beat the lizard people? Are we going to beat the lizard people? did you see the CEO of Pfizer breathing through his gills?
I try not to comment on any individuals specifically, but lizards more generally. I think Bitcoin is like a major tool in doing that. I think the internet was actually more powerful even than Bitcoin, and it's still underappreciated. And like, they weren't able to shut down the internet.
Yeah. It
created some gated communities and have blocked some information, but like the internet's still winning. And the same is going to happen with Bitcoin. Like, we're going to have free flowing information, free flowing value transfer across the economy in sound money. And then energy could be one of those next kind of
dominoes to fall.
Exactly.
Yeah. As they lose control, they try to tighten their grip on control, like this TikTok bill. I mean, I haven't done a full dissection of what's going on, but from the commentary I'm seeing from people I think I trust, like, it seems like it could be an attempt to attack the internet. And like, if what I'm reading from people who are commenting on the bill is correct, like TFTC could eventually, the website, get like shut down by the government if we put too much wrong think out there.
I don't know how you survived the last 4 years. So congrats. <Right. laughs> I was thinking about that last night.
We're a niche show. Niche show.
You're just under the cusp.
Yes,
there.
Yes. Yes. I officially made my first list. The what's it called, Logan? The Center for Countering Digital Hate put me on a list of 96.
Congratulations.
YouTube channels spreading new denial.
Do you get a plaque for that or something?
I should. I should. But yeah, I'm a new denier in the realm of climate science. I thought they were going to get me for COVID, but they came at me for climate.
Even better. I think it's there's potential to be a very crazy year when it comes to censorship and elections and what happens economically, what happens across the board. So got to be ready for anything at this point.
Yeah. And we need people like yourself, like others, instilling confidence in like the middle 30% or like the silent majority, or the silent majority, the middle 60% really, that are like, all right, which way do I go? Do I just be docile and comply with what the government's telling me? Or is there a critical mass of people that if I were to back them and stand up and say, no, fuck this, I'm mad as hell, we're not taking this anymore, would that be effective? That's why we do the show. That's why we do what we're both doing in the Bitcoin world. It's like proving like, hey, you can do good things, do virtuous things, do it and make money. Not only money, the best money that humans have ever come into contact with, and get away from these authoritarians that really just want to control you at the end of the day.
Yeah, we're going to win.
Yes.
You say that, I say that. And it's not just, you know, it's not a given, but to win, you have to believe that you can win.
Yes.
And so I think Bitcoin has been really nice. It kind of gives a lot of us additional leverage and courage to be thinking that. But even without it, like if we care about life and we care about living, we care about humanity, then we have to think we can win and we can do more of that.
No, that's, people think we're going to win is like a cocky statement steeped in hubris, but it's exactly that. Just trying to instill confidence. Like you got to believe you can win before you even get on the field, or it's not worth stepping on the field in the first place.
I think more of that and less dunking on poor people would be nice in the Bitcoin community.
We call them poor.
It's messed up.
I was shocked. I did not think he would go to that level.
Well, it is what it is.
It's hard to resist the urge to just be like, all right, have fun staying poor when you have the speaking head types and the high finance guys saying like Bitcoin's going to zero, I'm never going to adopt this. It's like, all right, we'll have fun staying poor.
Yeah, to that audience, I can see the allure.
Yeah, negging the rich people's fun. It's
better to build, though.
Yeah.
It's far more rewarding to build than to say things.
And I think where we are today, I mean, it's happening right now. We're literally at Builder's Day here at the Commons. Like, the last 3 years, that bear market, like, seeing what you've done at Satoshi Energy, what many others have done across the space, whether it's mining, wallet software, second layer solutions, like people are building, which is, we have fun telling people to have fun staying poor on the internet, but there are serious individuals who do not engage in that activity that are actually building valuable stuff.
Right. Yeah.
All right. What do you think we should wrap up with? Anything we didn't touch on that?
We covered a lot of bases, man. Yeah. I don't know. If you have any other questions, I'm happy to try and answer them.
Do you think the government's successful in their attacks in the Bitcoin mining industry over the next 2 years in any capacity? So I add more context. I got to believe systems like ERCOT, states like Texas, systems like the TVA have recognized the value that Bitcoin miners are providing. I find it hard to believe that they're going to be successful. I would hope that ERCOT, the TVA, individual utilities, energy companies are like, well, no, like you've destroyed our industry enough. Like we actually need this to be somewhat sustainable moving forward.
Yeah, I think it's hard for them to do. That said, I think the government is capable of doing anything through executive order or otherwise, as long as they have the support of the mainstream media to keep repeating it as if it's true in reality and the right thing to do. But I really do think, you know, if like a federal ban or massive tax on Bitcoin mining happened, I think that's just another step towards like the secession of Texas or other pockets of the United States, like just saying we're done with this. Like you can have that reality. We're gonna have our own.
Texit, baby.
Texit.
Texit.
Come
and take it. Literally. Like, all right. Have fun. Come and take it.
Right.
And like Bitcoin mining, I've talked about this for a while. Like energy rich states like Texas, Wyoming, Oklahoma. Like if they, because the big reason they don't secede if they don't agree with the federal government, is like they're dependent on those federal dollars to a lot of extents. But if you're energy rich, spin up a Bitcoin mining permanent fund.
Like, yeah, what are you going to take, some more printed dollars or 5 gigawatts of Bitcoin mining in your state? Yeah. Like, what's going to be a better source of capital?
Yeah. And again, just like we're reaching the inflection point of the career risk, I think we're reaching the inflection point of people straddling themselves to the dollar. I mean, like, there's going to be a point at some point soon, whether that's a year from now or 5 years from now, I think it's within that period where it's just abundantly clear that they have lost control. The dollar's a melting ice cube, as our friend who likes to call other people poor likes to say. And it's...
He has a lot of great things to say, by the way.
Yes.
I'm just not a fan of that one.
But I think there's going to be a point where it's like everybody jump ship. They're like, all right. It's like really like a Mexican standoff right now where it's like, it's still strong. It's still strong. And then there's going to be a point where it's obviously not strong. It's like, all right, we're in Bitcoin.
Yeah. That feels like this year, to be honest.
Yeah.
With all of the other things happening around the world, politically, in the media, it like the dam is breaking, and it feels like this is the year that it just like busts wide open.
Yeah.
Could take longer. You never know.
But I think the Middle East is going to get in a big way. And at that point, it's
going to be. That's right. Yeah. Nation state adoption. That's a big trend.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks for having me, man.
It's been
awesome.
It's been a long time coming. I'm happy we were finally able to do this. You got to do it more often. You got to come back to Austin more often.
Awesome. We'll do.
All right. We're going to get back to Builders Day. Peace and love, freaks.